This is lesson 16, okay? Lesson 16 is post-World War II, the expansion of new missions. Our title this time cannot refer to all that we want to include in this lesson, so you better look at the lesson outline and its five topics. One, the decline and fall of the IMC, the International Missionary Council. Two, post-War II surges in service missions, service in quotes. Three, the changing structure of global missions. And there are four subpoints: service agencies, internationalized agencies, and third world agencies. And four, the Lausanne Movement and the World Evangelical Association, the Great Commission Roundtable, and the Global Network of Mission Structures. And five, the focus on peoples and ethnic groups. The first, the decline and fall of the IMC. One of the most fascinating readings for this lesson is the one called The Legacy of Edinburgh 1910. It tells some of the details of an amazing and unexpected shift away from missions on the part of the first world-level body that attempted to represent mission agency structures. To give you a general idea, here, however, the International Missionary Council was formed as a direct result of the 1910 World Missionary Conference, which itself was the first in history on the world level of its kind. It was uniquely a conference of specifically missionaries and mission executives. As a direct result of this conference in 1910, the International Missionary Council came into being in 1921, delayed by the intervention of the First World War, and after John Mott, in one of his most impressive accomplishments, had helped to set in motion what eventually became 22 National Christian Councils, in the mission lands. These councils brought together in each country all the missionaries from whatever agencies were at work in those countries. An unexpected result, however, was that over the next several decades, national churches were being planted right and left, which began to produce impressive leaders. Once that happened extensively, it then seemed reasonable for these leaders to be included in the meetings of these various national Christian councils. That then led, in turn, gradually, for these national Christian councils to change their names to National Councils of Churches, same NCC. India, for example, had one of the largest such councils and did not change its name, but it did change its structure when, in 1945, on the encouragement of mission executives who were present, it voted that expatriate mission leaders could no longer vote. To vote, you had to be a national church leader. This was understood as a desirable nationalization. Now, depending upon your perspective, this was a great achievement when all of these councils became church councils, but it unintentionally maimed totally the parent body, the International Missionary Council, which was a council of councils. But it unintentionally maimed fatally the parent body, the International Missionary Council. Although the Western country councils were still mission agency executives, the 22 overseas council people became solidly church leaders. In 1958 at Ghana, the IMC voted to merge with the World Council of Churches, and the idea of seeing things at a global level through the eyes of mission executives was no more. This cursory summary will at least give you an idea of why there needed to be another 1910-type conference in 1980, and why, though in vain, that conference attempted to establish another world-level structure representing mission agencies. That world-level structure did not come into being until 2005, being essentially an outcome of what they called Singapore 2002, a conference convened specifically to maintain momentum in their unreached people's sphere. The new organization was called the Global Network of Mission Structures, as will be mentioned further below. Then, two, post-war II surges in service missions. A second unexpected event of monumental proportions followed the Second World War, which was also of monumental proportions. As with all wars, it was a great tragedy. But good things do come out of tragedies on occasion. It was as if we collected up enough money to send 11 million of our own people on a world tour, rubbing their faces in heretofore almost unknown mission work in the Pacific Islands, for example, that Japanese would never have been routed had it not been for the fact that half of the island people were Christians who identified with the countries which had sent the missionaries. Then, in the first 5 years after the war, the returning war-enlightened service personnel formed 150 new mission agencies. This surge of new agencies would have constituted a new era in our analysis of the three eras had they dealt with some new frontier of mission, such as the bypassed unreached peoples, which have more recently been addressed. Although the GIs didn't start a new era, they started a huge new push into the world of missions of the U.S. population. You might say that World War II was perhaps the greatest surge in mission awareness, even beyond the student volunteer movement half a century earlier. The unique feature of these 150 new mission agencies was their stress on technical services to existing mission agencies. The former military personnel had gained skills in radio, flying planes, printing, managing, making tough decisions, and the new missions reflected these technical skills. 3, the changing structures of global missions. The first of all are the new category of service missions we've just mentioned. These emphasize, as I say, radio, planes, literacy, child events, etc. We could add relief and development agencies as well, whose concerns were spurred by the direct contact of GIs with conditions in foreign lands. But then secondly, there were what you call internationalized missions. There were many agencies which, one by one, puzzled their way through the transformation from a national agency serving internationally to a truly internationalized agency, which drew more and more personnel, drew more people from... Let me start this over. The transformation from a nationalized, from a national agency serving internationally to a truly internationalized agency which drew from more than one country, and in some cases forthrightly drew overseas national leadership into membership. These mutations were not all simple. There's no book on how to internationalize an international a national agency serving internationally, unfortunately. But by the year 2000, dozens of missions had added the word international to their name, whatever it meant. That word used in that way, however, has no precise technical significance. It usually simply means that other Western countries are collaborating in support of the new internationalized agency. In some cases, as with the Overseas Missionary Fellowship, more and more non-Western personnel are actually becoming members. Interestingly enough, two agencies stressing the involvement of young people began almost from their founding to absorb into their ranks new members from any part of the world. I speak of Operation Mobilization and Youth with a Mission. In the latter case, hundreds of completely different corporations undergird an equal number of bases around the world. These bases then cooperate significantly, even if not formally. In the case of YWAM, at least three structures produce a functional matrix in addition by running across all the bases. First, the University of the Nations Global Program. They have 25,000 students. And secondly, the Mercy Ships Global Program. And thirdly, the most recent, a Frontier Missions Church Planning Division. Then Third World Missions. This is the third type of new structure that emerged. Although new structures of missions regrettably although, I'll start over. Third World Missions. Another new structure of missions, regrettably new, because it should have been attempted long ago, is the idea of the overseas national churches themselves forming their own mission-sending structures. These are sometimes called Third World Missions. Probably the major exception to the rule that none of the Western missions ever thought of such a thing or initiated such structures is the exception of the Christian Missionary Alliance and its work in Southeast Asia. There, but nowhere else in their global outreach, that agency has made sure that their planted national churches always had a mission department, such that missionaries going from the Philippines under the CMA would be sponsored and supported by CMA churches in the Philippines, not by the CMA headquarters in the United States. Then, the focus on peoples and ethnic groups. The biggest change in strategic perspective in the 20th century was an outgrowth of the impact of the thinking of Donald McGavran, a third-generation missionary to India, for whom the invisible barriers of culture, not just language, had become visible and all-important. He figured that once even a lone individual from one group had become a Christian, that person should not be encouraged to join the existing church of another group, but should be perceived as a, quote, bridge of God back into his own group. Thus, the very fact that someone within a group had for the first time gained an understanding of the gospel was an event much more strategic than the fact that one more person followed Christ within a group where many were already Christians. Why is that? Because now a whole new group was suddenly made penetrable. His specific application of this insight was, however, almost exclusively that of detecting people in the back rows of an existing church, which he would call a conglomerate church, composed of different ethnic groups, and taking the advantage of that bridge of God in the back row into a new compartment of society which heretofore was sealed off by cultural barriers. My take from this insight was that if such invisible barriers of culture were as important as McGavran made them out to be, then all such sealed-off groups which had no converts at all in other parts of the world were in really bad shape and deserved special attention. At first, McGavran was very reluctant about this new emphasis on what became called unreached peoples. He wanted to be sure that we did not overlook any existing, quote, bridge of God, unquote, in a concern to start from scratch with new groups. In hindsight, it's obvious that both concerns were valid, and within a very short time, several years actually, McGavran got on board with the Unreached Peoples movement, and so did many other agencies that now became indebted to his original insight about the strategic importance of cultural barriers. Unfortunately, however, now and then someone may consider the idea of homogeneous churches a form of racism, but one man's racism is another man's freedom of self-determination. There is certainly nothing racist about people finding it easier to speak their own language and enjoying the benefits of mutual recognition of cultural traditions. The very idea of black power, brown power, and other types of cultural pride serve to underscore the truth of McGavran's position. 5. The Lausanne Movement, the WEA, the GCR, and the GNMS. In the wake of the breakdown of the IMC, Carl F. H. Henry, one of the most prominent evangelical theologians, and whose wife was the daughter of a missionary to Cameroon, persuaded Billy Graham to go with him in sponsoring a world-level conference on evangelism in Berlin in 1966. This turned out to be so successful that a second larger one, with a greater emphasis on mission, was convened in 1974 in Switzerland, in the city of Lausanne. The International Congress on World Evangelization at Lausanne was far more influential than Berlin. About 20% of its participants represented cross-cultural mission outreach. Widely known and respected is the Lausanne Covenant, which was drafted by John R. Stott and formulated in final form by a committee during the Congress itself. The Lausanne Covenant has a substantial section on missions, but it talks somewhat as if the whole thing has been pretty much of a failure and is still up against virtually hopeless odds. In a later Lausanne-sponsored conference in the Philippines in 1987, the Manila Manifesto, as it's called, had a much more significant section on missions, incorporating direct input from people at the USCWM. John R. Stott was again the chief drafter. A key feature of the Lausanne movement, and there have been many regional Lausanne conferences across the years, has been its inclusiveness when compared to the meetings of the World Evangelical Fellowship, which is now called the World Evangelical Alliance. The WEA has all along been dominated by denominations as members, which match up to the WEA's very explicit statement of faith. The Lausanne movement takes in local churches and individuals, no matter what their denominational relationships might be. At a Lausanne-sponsored meeting, it would be easy to run into a representative of, quote, the Lord's Army, unquote, which is a movement of 500,000 people in Romania, but not a denomination, or a member of the Lutheran Church of Latvia, even though such Christian leaders would never appear at a WEA meeting, and in reverse, the WEA would be unheard of in such circles. A second feature of the Lausanne movement is that, true to its origin, it consistently includes church leaders, even high officials in the older pre-evangelical churches, with the idea of evangelizing them on the subject of evangelism at the conference itself. Back in 1974, my talk was censored before the meeting, eliminating any use of the word mission. I had to use the title Cross-Cultural Evangelism, the highest priority. I had to convert my own M1, M2, M3 codes to E1, E2, and E3, thus exchanging the word mission for evangelism. I understand that Billy Graham feels that he can escape some governmental opposition by talking solely about evangelism as the initiative of citizens within a country and not referring to organizations like missions that seek to influence from outside the country. He has a point, but of course his logic then depends solely upon people already existing in the country or within a people group who are willing and able to evangelize. That is, his perspective depends on previous missions. In the case of unreached peoples, note, these are precisely those places who have not yet had any previous missions. At the present time, the executive director of the Lausanne movement, Douglas Birdsall, happens to be, at the same time, a mission executive. And the international director of the Lausanne movement, Tetsunao Yamamori, was also an active missionary for many years. This promises a good deal of change, perhaps, beyond the most recent Lausanne global meeting in Thailand, which out of 46 tracts of interest accorded only one half of one tract to unreached peoples. The Norwegian Missionary Council was always one of the strong forces in the IMC. And when the latter became assimilated into the World Council of Churches, the Norwegian Missionary Council was, along with other Western Mission Agency councils and associations, left somewhat high and dry. In fact, some thinkers arrived at the conclusion that due to the widespread growth of overseas churches in virtually every country, mission sending structures were now completely out of date, and thus agencies such as the Norwegian Missionary Council were dinosaurs which we could do without. This perspective has merits in all cases where national churches already exist. But now, widely, the nations of the world are no longer conceived of as the countries of the world, but rather are conceived of as the roughly 24,000 peoples of the world. As a result, traditional missionary perspective is now back again in favor, and in fact, is clearly impelling in view of the serious possibility that current overseas churches might ignore the very existence of minorities and even majorities within their countries that are outside the spheres of their existing churches. Indeed, the ethnic tensions within countries are not minor but major factors in mission strategy. It is entirely understandable and yet entirely unreasonable to suppose that a church movement within one ethnic group in a country will automatically reach out effectively to other ethnic groups when those other groups are, as is often the case, centuries-old enemies. Indeed, the anthropological dictum that, quote, the closest are furthest, unquote, holds true with dire effect in the majority of all cases of ethnic near neighbors. For example, a Navajo evangelist would be more welcome among the Norwegian Laplanders in the north of Norway than would Norwegians living nearby, who might resent or be resented by the Laplanders. Similarly, a Canadian missionary would tend to be more welcome among the Zuni Indians of Arizona than a white citizen from Phoenix. These realities help us to understand why mission strategy is not always intuitively obvious. They also explain why it is that just sending money around the world to people who are then supposed to evangelize their near neighbors is unwise more often than not. It also explains why short-termers who don't tie into long-term missionary work on the field are unlikely to do more than to get themselves a valuable cross-cultural experience, their real contribution to missions being of little value or perhaps even harmful. Finally, the very complexity of mission strategy helps us understand why local churches are unlikely to be successful in sending their own missionaries without sending them through existing veteran agencies that have bumped into many of the unsuspected features of field strategy. But back to the Norwegian Missionary Council, left high and dry by the demise of the International Missionary Council. It took the initiative to form what later developed into the Great Commission Roundtable. The process was set in motion in a meeting hosted in Hurdal, Norway, by the Norwegian Missionary Council, composed of representatives of the 82,000 movement, the Lausanne Committee for World Evangelization, the World Evangelical Fellowship, now called World Evangelical Alliance, and the Billy Graham Association. Representatives of all but the latter met again several times later, and there now exists a global-level, quote, roundtable of these key entities. Mission executives as such are not prominent, but the GCRT was consulted in the formation of the Global Network of Mission Structures and gave it its blessing. The GNMS itself was founded in Amsterdam in April of 2005 in a meeting intentionally small. About 30 representative mission leaders from the entire world voted to establish an office in Malaysia, it turned out, to coordinate further discussion. A corporation was later formed, and the outlook is now very positive. There are many national and regional associations of mission agencies. They can, and they do, confer about matters concerning their territories. However, only a global entity can best track migrating peoples, which today go all over the world. Since it's usually true that a given group can be more easily reached in one location than in another, it's the crucial task of the GNMS to track them down.